This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Insightly Customer Relationship Management. Insightly is designed to help small businesses manage contacts, projects, and sales with ease. More information at insightly.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll spend some time on the week that was. We'll touch on corporate news and oil. We'll do a little education. And then, zombies from American public media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. Learn more at Moo.com. And by Nuance Power PDF, a scalable solution designed to accurately convert, combine, and edit business documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 24th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We are not going to waste any time today. We are just going to get right to it. Crisp, to-the-point analysis of what happened in business and the economy the past 5 days. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Also, Felix Salmon from Fusion. Hello to you both.
Hey, Kai.
Hello, Kai.
So, Felix, let me start with you. This has been a rough week for the blue chips in the American economy, right? McDonald's, IBM, Coke all reported profits that were not so great. What do you suppose is going on?
Well, the profits couldn't go on forever, could they? They were
well, no.
All the profits were going up even as the rest of us weren't earning any more money, and there's a limit to how long that can continue. And I feel like this is finally the end of the, or could possibly finally be the end of the massive ramp up of the money all going to capital and not going to the main, you know, to labor or the rest of us. Can I hope?
Yeah, I don't know. Catherine, what do you think? Does that theory hold?
I think what's going on with each of those stocks is pretty idiosyncratic to many of the stocks themselves, I would say. But I think Felix is right that they've had a really good run that doesn't seem entirely justified by the underlying state of the economy in the United States. I think part of the other issue is that to the extent that the demand from the rest of the world was sustaining a lot of the big companies, we've seen a slowdown in Europe, we've seen a slowdown in China, and so you might be seeing some global factors weighing on them as well.
Felix, talk to me about that for a second. China reported gross domestic product this week. It was 7.3%, which by our standards is spectacular, by Chinese standards lousy. Are we suffering? Is the American economy suffering because everybody else is slowing down?
Not yet. I mean, China's just beginning to slow down. Europe's been slow for the past 4 years, so that's nothing new.
Right.
But it probably will. And remember, the stock prices are meant to be trying to price in what happens in the future. So if China continues like this, then that's going to be bad because, you know, China is the big source of demand for commodities and the big engine of the global economy right now. It's not sputtering, but as you say, 7.3%, that's the lowest figure in over 5 years.
5 years, yeah. So, Catherine, take me away for a minute from the markets and from corporate this and corporate that. I want to look for a second at commodities prices, specifically oil, right? When we see oil going down to where it is, $80-something dollars a barrel, and gas is, I think the average price is like $3 plus or minus nationwide, that is a good thing for consumers, but conceivably portends ill global economy-wise, right?
Well, it depends on whether you think prices are falling because of supply or demand or some combination of the two. I mean, if you think prices are falling because demand is falling, then that doesn't bode particularly well, right? I mean, it means that that other countries, well, us and other countries, you know, aren't trying to consume as much of this stuff, possibly because they have other problems facing them. and they don't need as much energy as a result.
Right. Felix, are you secure or insecure about the state of the global economy?
Reasonably secure. I'm not panicking. I think actually these lower oil prices are good. You know, lower oil prices will encourage people to consume more energy, to produce more stuff. And at the margin, lower oil prices mean greater GDP growth and more money for the rest of us who aren't oil companies. Mm-hmm. So that's good. I'm not, China's still growing at 7.3%, which is pretty fast. The U.S. is still growing. The U.K. had a pretty impressive growth figure out this week. So I'm not pessimistic yet.
Yet. All right. Felix Salmon from Felix Salmon from Fusion and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Thank you both. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, green arrows all the way around. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Two weeks ago, Dr. Craig Spencer was treating Ebola patients in Guinea. He is now, as you know, in isolation at Bellevue Hospital in Manhattan after testing positive for that disease. City officials are doing what city officials do in these sorts of circumstances, explaining exactly how difficult it is to contract Ebola, which is, by the way, very difficult, but at the same time retracing Spencer's recent steps through New York. They've got his own account of his whereabouts to go on, but also multiple electronic checkpoints of life in the big city. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
From your commute on the subway to your morning coffee to your taxi ride.
Taxi!
And Facebook updates, we are all leaving a digital wake.
There's a whole field of digital epidemiology that's emerged, harnessing these sort of new digital data streams, almost like digital exhaust, for the purposes of public health.
John Brownstein is an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Let's start with Dr. Spencer's Uber ride. That's the subscription taxi service.
You can quickly get access to, of course, the driver, distance, locations that driver went to, and of course, the other passengers of that vehicle.
Or when we log on to Wi-Fi at the coffee shop.
Where we looked at people's access to free wireless networks across the city. And so we could tell when two people were close to one another and how they move around, and we could model the spread of the disease.
Smartphones ping email servers regularly with their locations and IP addresses. Even keychains can send information that can be picked up by your car or another car. But there is one big caveat to using all this data.
It's not easy and it's not automatic.
Gavin Maines is CEO of Avancic, a digital forensics firm. Take the subway. You can see what subway card was swiped right after a sick person's, but then you have to connect that to a credit card and then connect the credit card to a person, probably through a credit card company.
There is no computer sitting in someone's basement that's automatically tracking that material together.
The data is big and so is the city. Sifting through both is a monumental task. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
From the consumer products behemoth Procter & Gamble this morning, a sort of so-so third-quarter profit report. But buried a ways down from the headline number was this, an announcement that P&G is going to unload Duracell. It does have 25% of the worldwide battery market, Duracell does, but it's just not growing like it used to. Marketplace's Adrian Hill takes a look at the past and future, perhaps, of the iconic battery.
Duracell got its start in World War II. Eric Hintz is an historian at the Smithsonian.
The U.S. military had an insatiable demand for batteries to power all kinds of mobile equipment, including walkie-talkies and minesweepers.
But its batteries weren't cutting it. Enter inventor Samuel Rubin and the PR Mallory Company. They produced a better mercury battery, but it was expensive. Hintz says the company really took off with consumers when it developed cheaper alkaline batteries and teamed up with Kodak on the Instamatic and Super 8 cameras.
Mallory supplied Kodak with batteries at no cost. In exchange, Kodak placed a warning on each camera's battery compartment stating that the warranty would be null and void unless users restocked with Mallory's new AA alkaline batteries.
Fast forward, Mallory alkaline manganese batteries become Duracell batteries and grab a quarter of the global battery market. But now, disposable alkaline batteries are being replaced by rechargeable lithium-ion batteries. Part of the reason P&G is spinning Duracell off. Vishal Sapru is an analyst at Frost & Sullivan.
From your cell phones to your laptops to your power tools, you name them, lithium-ion is making significant headway into that business.
But he doubts Duracell will go the way of its old friend Kodak anytime soon. There's an ease to disposables, he says, that's still hard for other batteries to beat. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Crude oil, as I was talking about with Catherine and Felix, held steady today at $81-ish a barrel at the close in New York. Part of the reason for the recent tumble in oil prices is what we are doing here to get more of it out of the ground. I speak of fracking, of course. Fracking is not, it is safe to say, universally popular. And there is a referendum on the ballot in a city deep in the heart of oil country, Denton, Texas, north of Dallas, that would ban fracking. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the ground in Denton. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So this is kind of it, right? This is where fracking basically began, isn't it?
Indeed. At least the modern era of fracking, which, as you know, thrusts water and sand and chemicals way down to shatter rocks and release oil and gas that's kind of trapped inside. It started in this exact part of Texas. It's called the Barnett Shale. To start out, I want to play you a piece of sound. And imagine you live right next door to this drill rig. Or a compressor facility or something that's, I mean, it's 80 yards from people's homes.
Wow.
I walked it off. Like a lot of places, drilling proximity to people's homes is the issue.
Yeah, no, I bet. And the whole neighborhood hates it, right? I mean, the china on the wall vibrates and everything.
Well, unless you own the rights to the oil and gas down below, right? The so-called mineral rights. And if you've let the drillers come on and lease your property, suddenly you share the spoils, right? Suddenly that sound is kind of the happy music. This is what splits neighborhoods, including the city of Denton. So I'm going to play a sound from two voters on separate sides of this referendum.
Okay.
And these fracking operators come in and start building these wells, and there's air pollution, there's truck traffic, there's noise pollution, kind of things that you didn't expect. So it's really an issue about quality of life.
To ban or not to ban?
Everyone that owns mineral rights in the state of Texas has something at risk here. You know, I wouldn't want to see those people. It'd be a bad way to lose your investment. It's bad to have the will of the voter overturn more than a century-old industry.
Yeah, but Scott, wait a second. That guy, the second cut there said, you know, everybody in Texas is worried about this. This is a Denton vote, right?
Indeed, it's just the city of Denton. But for proponents of the industry, for the companies, I mean, they tell me they're worried a ban in this city could invite copycats across the state. It's not even just Texas watching this. The day I went to cover this, a French reporter was there. Many other countries are also sitting on these geologic shale formations and watching this American fossil fuel revolution. What are the benefits? What are the costs? We're asking these questions. They're asking these questions.
Before I let you go, Scott, we got like half a minute here. What does it feel like on the ground, right? I mean, it's politics there now, isn't it?
It's political season, and this is now a theological issue. So nuance doesn't stand a chance. That's to be expected. What I didn't expect was how one-sided this feels. I mean, the anti-fracking folks are grassroots. You can call them on their cell phone. The pro-industry side is invisible. You know, three drilling companies have almost entirely bankrolled that side. They've funneled money into a political campaign firm that's created TV ads, but you can't find the people to talk to. Now, in their defense, you know, it's hard for industry to catch a break. Not many of us think through that these companies would never exist if we didn't buy their product.
Yeah. True enough. Marketplace's Scott Tong on the ground in Denton, Texas. Stories forthcoming from his reporting trip there. Scott, thanks very much.
Okay, Kai. Thank you.
Coming up,
people are not really feeling like they're being sold a product or a logo.
Product placement in the DVR age. But first, let's do the numbers. The happy music on a Friday. The Dow Industrial's up 127 points today, 0.75%, closed at 16,805. The NASDAQ up 30.7%. Ended things at 44.83. The S&P 500 advanced 13.7%, closed at 1964. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 2.6%, the NASDAQ up 5.3%, the S&P 500 gained 0.4%. Microsoft up almost 2.5% today on better-than-expected quarterly sales and growth in its cloud computing business. Amazon went the other way, down 8.3%. The online retailer yesterday posted its biggest quarterly net loss in more than a decade. Bonds were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cabot Creamery Cooperative, generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce cheddar cheese and other dairy foods. By MailChimp, more than 7 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. And by Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos all available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. Want to tell your story? Be part of our listener-generated series, I've Always Wondered, featuring questions from you about the economy. Submit your story and check out the ones we've already done at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors issues its September Pending Home Sales Index. Twitter reports quarterly earnings. And start the week off with a beer. Well, maybe not at work. Monday is American Beer Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. It's Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The higher education assumption in this country is that everybody should go to college. The reality is, though, that not everybody wants to. And in fact, about a third of all high school seniors don't. But those kids do need skills to get good jobs, skills that a lot of experts say traditional academic high schools just aren't delivering. Vocational high schools are increasingly being seen as one solution, and not just for kids who don't plan to go to college, but for kids who might otherwise have dropped out of high school altogether. We told you yesterday on the program how vocational high schools are broadening their roles beyond just teaching trades like welding and plumbing. Today, in part two of her report, Emily Hanford takes us back to Minuteman High School outside of Boston, Mass.
Liz King grew up in a wealthy Boston suburb where pretty much everyone goes to college. But she's known since middle school that's not what she wanted.
I'm not a book person. You know you are, you're not.
There was something she really liked, though.
I always enjoyed, like, fiddling with people's hair. One of my best friends in middle school, her mom owned her own salon, so we'd go hang out at her salon.
King wanted to open her own salon someday, but she had 4 years of high school to get through first, and she was dreading it. Then, near the end of eighth grade, she met a rep from Minuteman High, a nearby vocational school. She learned she could go to Minuteman and study cosmetology.
I wasn't having any of that.
That's King's mom, Jeanette Chapman. Years earlier, her son had asked to go to Minuteman to study plumbing. She said no to him, too.
I just had the impression that he would miss out on something, a profession, where you could make more money. I think it was all to do with making more money.
She wanted her kids to go to college. Polls show this is what most American parents want. But a lot of young adults don't make it through college.
The reality is that by the time they get to the late 20s, only 30% of young people have actually gotten a four-year degree.
Bill Simons is director of the Global Pathways Institute, an organization that advocates for career education.
So you've got a paradigm that's embraced by almost everybody, but only 30% are getting there.
Simons says high schools focus too much on getting everyone to college. But there's value in a good hands-on technical education. Employers agree. In a 2011 survey, three-quarters of executives at U.S. manufacturing companies said a shortage of skilled workers was having a significant impact on their company's ability to expand. David Cox is a general manager at the Toyota plant in Georgetown, Kentucky.
There's a basic mindset problem still in high school that you're either college-bound or you're going to work at McDonald's.
At Minuteman, students spend half their time in academic classes and half in a vocational major. They can choose high-tech fields like robotics and computer programming. They can also learn traditional trades like plumbing and carpentry. This is Steve Hurley, a student in the electrical wiring program, learning how to install a light switch. He says he chose Minuteman because...
I just didn't want to get out of high school and not know what I was going to do with my life and stay working at a grocery store.
Hurley just graduated with a certificate that helped him get started as an electrician's apprentice. If he becomes a certified electrician, he can expect to make about $40,000 a year to start. That's higher than the median wage for all workers in the United States. And a college degree isn't necessary.
College isn't for everyone.
Michelle Roach is director of career and technical education at Minuteman. She says lots of kids who might otherwise drop out of high school end up thriving in vocational school.
Students who have not felt success when they're in a traditional academic school where they've got to sit, the teacher's talking at them, they'll come here and they're standing on their feet, they're working with their hands, they make something work, they figure out a problem, and success breeds success.
Graduation rates at regional vocational high schools in Massachusetts are actually higher than at traditional high schools.
Come on down.
Okay. This is Liz King again. She's 28 now, and she recently opened her own salon. One of her regular clients has just come in.
All right, let's talk.
So I need color.
Yes.
To convince her mom to let her go to Minuteman all those years ago, King made a promise. She'd take all the college prep classes in case she changed her mind about being a hairdresser. But she says she made the right choice.
If I went to college, I would waste a crap load of money. I knew I wasn't good at studying. I was a procrastinator. And if someone was like, hey, Liz, let's go party. Hey, Liz, let's go not study. Hey, Liz, I would have been like, okay.
King says some people may look down on her because she doesn't have a college degree, but she doesn't care. She's married, has a baby.
We're good. We're comfortable. We're paying our bills.
And she's doing what she loves. Ed Boquillan, superintendent of the school district where Minuteman is located, says high schools need to do more to help students figure this out. When parents are trying to decide whether to send their kids to Minuteman, here's what Boquillan tells them.
We're a school that's going to help your kid answer two very simple questions. What do I do well, and what do I love to do? And we'll connect the answers to occupations or college majors.
Boquillan says when he asks parents if they know the answers to those two questions, some say, yeah, and some say, boy, I wish someone had asked me that in high school. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
Emily's story is part of an hour-long documentary on vocational education produced by American Radio Works. You can hear the whole thing through a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. I don't do zombies. I just don't. But 17 million of you do. The Walking Dead on AMC got that many viewers for its season 5 premiere a couple of weeks ago. And while I'm told there have been plenty of zombies on screen, there is one character that's been missing from the show. A Hyundai SUV. Seems the survivors are getting around on foot this season, and therein lies something of a lesson in modern-day product placement, Nova Sappho reports.
If you've watched The Walking Dead, you've seen lots of shots of a gleaming Hyundai SUV in a grimy zombie world. It's been enough to inspire this YouTube parody.
Walkers, we need to get out of here right now. Run them over.
I won't do it.
We just killed like 6 in the last 10 minutes.
The 2011 Hyundai Tucson is the greatest piece of human engineering in existence, and I will not use it as a weapon, roll over zombie hordes like a tank.
The video is courtesy of Warp Zone, a team of 520-somethings. Brian Fisher is one of the 5. He says Hyundai in The Walking Dead was pretty obvious product placement.
It kind of, like, almost doesn't make sense in the context that it's in. It's like it should be bloodied up and have more damage to it.
It would make sense if it was a truck instead of a family SUV, says Damaris Valero. She's the author of the book Branded Entertainment. Valero says it's no longer enough to just place a brand into a storyline. The two have to make sense together.
And in that way, people are not really feeling like they're being sold a product or a logo.
Valero says product placement is more successful when there's interaction between brand and story. Think the Mini Coopers in The Italian Job, or the Aston Martins and BMWs in the Bond movies. She also says advertisers are becoming more savvy, asking for input into the content creation process.
A lot of times they are allowed to sit with the scriptwriters so that they're able to understand what the brand stands for so that they can capture the essence of that brand.
Whatever the terms, brands are seeing benefits if their growing numbers in TV and film are any indication. About a decade ago, the James Bond film Die Another Day made headlines for having 20 marketing partners. Last year, the latest Superman movie had 100. And on the TV side, advertisers will spend $6 billion on branded content this year. And that number is going up, says Paul Dargaribedian. He's a senior analyst with Rentrak, a firm that keeps tabs on film and TV financials.
Particularly in the world of DVRing a show, so to speak, you may have a lot of people skipping over commercials. Well, then you have to weave those products into the show.
For Hyundai in The Walking Dead, the company says it's happy with the amount of attention it got from the partnership. After all, even that YouTube parody featured a gleaming new Hyundai SUV. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palo Alto Networks, delivering a next-generation security platform designed from the ground up to prevent today's advanced cyber attacks. Palo Alto Networks, the enterprise security company. By Robert W. Baird & Company, employee-owned and independent, Baird has kept clients' financial interests first since 1919. BairdWealth.com has more information. And by Wix.com, giving millions of business owners the ability to create their own professional website. You can create a website today online at Wix.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, a follow-up to our story yesterday about email and how companies far and wide are trying to come up with apps to free us from the tyranny of our inboxes. Our own Amy Scott ended her piece yesterday on the story with this.
I have 49,493 emails in my inbox. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott. Uh-oh, there's the IT department now for Marketplace.
So we found out after we went off the air that that's not far from what actually happened. We've got Amy on the line now for a follow-up. Hey, Amy.
Hey there.
So tell us what happened, would you?
Well, actually, to make matters worse, I got an email from IT, of all things.
Saying?
A very polite one, saying, can we help you deal with that?
Okay, so we have our head IT person here at Marketplace, Tinson Lee, in the studio. And here's the question, and this is totally serious. Why can't we, since it's all ones and zeros, right, all you guys have to do is throw another server on there or whatever, why can't we have as many emails as we want?
Well, we just don't want to promote hoarding. Because, you're looking through 15 million emails.
Yeah, so, for instance.
Yeah, for instance. So you want to reduce that amount, make it more efficient for Outlook.
Fair enough.
Kai, can I just say something?
Of course.
To me, this comes down to how you want to waste your company's money. Do you want to waste it taking up valuable storage?
I don't want to waste my company's money. Why would you want to waste your company's money?
Well, if you're going to go through all those emails and sort through them, that's a waste too. So
what should we do? We should do a little manicure in here, right?
For sure.
Well, as it happens, yes. I did delete all 49,000 last
night. No way. Did you really?
There. That should make Tinson happy.
Are you now at inbox zero?
Oh, no, that was just the unread emails.
No, how do you have 49,000 unread emails? All right. Anyway, Amy Scott, Tinson Lee from our email desk. See you guys. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
49,000 unread emails. Do us a favor. Send us a screenshot of your inbox counter. Tweet us at Marketplace. We've already got one, by the way, one submission with over 218,000 emails in it. See if you can beat it. Go ahead. I dare you. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow up 127 points. That's about 0.75%. The NASDAQ up 30.7%. The S&P 500 gained 13 points, also 0.7%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.